بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. This is the third lecture of our series trying to understand religion in the contemporary world. The purpose of initiating this series was to take stock of the changing world from the lens of religion. The world is changing. Religion wants to speak at all times, under all circumstances, but it will speak according to the conditions of the time. It doesn't mean that it will change with time. It means only that the core of religion, of any religion whatsoever, does not change. It is totally part of the creation in which change doesn't come the way society changes. So there is a core to the human being, and the purpose for which religion says humans have been created. So there is a fixed factor, but the fixed factor is capable of looking at the world before it came, during the time it is alive, and the times which will come after it. This is how religion takes stock of the changing world. It is willing to go back into time, willing to go forward, and then also commenting on the present day situation as well. We started off by challenging an understanding of religion as a social construct in the first lecture, and bringing proof from anthropologists and anthropological linguists who have offered proof that the idea of a metaphysical god was there among the hunter-gatherers, and in their language it meant somebody who does not need food or someone who doesn't excrete. That is a metaphysical phenomenon. So this was very useful in the study of religion, because till now, till up to the 80s, this idea was alien, and it was always considered that human beings were responsible for creating religion in the name of God. This observation at least gave some permanence to the idea of religion, that it is not born out of society. It is the capability of the human being to appreciate things beyond him, and therefore develop this concept of a metaphysical entity considered to be the creator. We move forward on the same basis and said that the Quran specifically speaks of God as being near to the human being. The verses we quoted were numerous. نَحْنُ أَقْرَبُ إِلَيْهِ مِنْ حَبْلِ الْوَرِيدِ. We are closer to him than his own jugular vein. هُوَ مَعَكُمْ أَيْنَمَا كُنْتُمْ. He is with you wherever you are. He is the fourth when you are three. He is the sixth when you are five. These verses are indicative of God being together always as part of the human structure. Other verses are also there which say that God intervenes between man and his heart. يَحُولُ بَيْنَ الْمَرْءِ وَقَلْبِهِ. That's the verse. And we identify ourselves with our heart, with our mind. And God says, between you and your heart and you and your mind, I am there. These are the things which gave us the opportunity to understand God as being with us, in us, and therefore not requiring an external proof per se. Because if we go in for external proof, we would at least require people capable of understanding the unknown in a better way. But initially, we quoted also Adam and his children, specifically Adam and Cain, and the event in which Cain killed Abel, and the reason was not knowing God. The reason was offering a sacrifice to God and he accepting it from Abel and not accepting it from Cain, because it was not offered with piety, taqwa, God-wariness, God-consciousness. So at the beginning of mankind, the issue was never God. And the Quran again says, we have all spoken about these verses in the earlier two lectures. Afillahi shakkun fatiru samawati wa fatiru samawati wal ars. Is there any doubt about God, the creator of the heavens and the earth? So we now have two kinds of things happening. One, science, material sciences, and secondly, human studies such as anthropology, sociology, linguistics, all coming together and giving us a support to the idea of God and religion vis-a-vis man. And it looks to be something so inherently close to the human identity that to expect human beings to have a system in which God doesn't exist for them is an impossibility. And to run a society which is totally not based on God is again another impossibility. So as we see our growth coming about, we hold on to God, his name at least, and do not go into the ramifications of accepting God. We don't go into the ramifications of accepting God. So we do swear by God. We do have a constitution which incorporates God. We have a king who is the head of state, or the queen who is the head of state, as well as the head of the church. We have all this. But again, we have it and accept it from a distance. This ideology, I have not named it in the last two lectures, but it has a name. It's called deism. D-E-I-S-M. And it means that there is a creator, but he has nothing to do with us. He's created and he's detached himself from the world. They say that I on the dollar note, and there being a gap between the pyramid and the head and the top of the pyramid is detached on the dollar, and there is an eye looking from there. This detachment was a symbolic representation of the victory of deism over theism in the United States. That means we accept God, but he has no role to play apart from having created us. So this kind of approach towards God has become popular among those who want to have God but don't want to have his presence felt either internally to them or externally in the society. This is the start of my third lecture. Do we take God and accept him without feeling him, or we need to feel him, sense him in a way, work with him on a daily basis, what in today's parlance would be called a personal God? Religions speak about personal God, be it Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, or any other religion. Buddhism doesn't speak very openly about it, but it does speak of the hereafter, and also speaks of the fact that had there not been the power to create the world and the hereafter after that on the basis of principles of dharma or dhamma, it wouldn't have been possible to have this world, neither the world of the hereafter, which would be the moksha and the nirvana aspect of it. And this is very clearly mentioned in Buddhist scriptures. So we have God who is involved and God who wants to work with us. Quran is very, very particular about this fact. It very openly speaks of a God more involved with us than we are involved with Him. More involved with us than we are involved with Him. He seems to take care of us at every step, reads us before we even understand ourselves, speaks about us in the Quran as knowing what is before you and what is gone before you. So what is going to come? يَعْلَمُ مَا بَيْنَ أَيْدِيهِمْ وَمَا خَلْفَهُمْ says the Ayatul Kursi. He knows that which is going to come, that which is in front of them, and that which has gone by. He, as I just quoted a verse, intervenes between us and our heart. When the human being wants to approach his heart, if he approaches it without God, his approach would be materialistic. And if God intervenes in between, that is, he comes between the man and his heart, as the verse of the Quran says, Yahulu bainal mar'i wa qalbi, then he goes and touches his heart, his soul touches his heart with God. What are these realities about which God is speaking? We need to understand that this is a pattern which we need to really go into in detail. If we don't go in detail into this pattern, we would be losing our way somewhere or the other. I move forward now, how the Quran speaks about the ghaib, how it says things which are not obvious are to be understood and how they need to be understood. We have it in the beginning of the Quran, after the Surah Al-Fatiha. We have Surah Al-Baqarah, in which God speaks about hidayat, guidance, through a book in which there is no error, no doubt. Hudal lil muttaqin allazina yu'minuna bil ghaib, says the Quran. Guidance to the God-weary, the God-conscious, who have faith in the unseen. Having faith in the unseen. It's guidance for the pious, the God-weary, the God-conscious, who are having faith in the unseen. Faith implies knowledge. Otherwise, it would become conjecture of the unseen. So when they have faith in the unseen, they are sure about it. What God wants here, human beings to do, and specifically those who are conscious of God in an elementary manner, in a very, very basic manner, the same way in which Abel and Cain were. Very basic manner. He wants them to cross the Rubicon and move forward and see how things operate in the world. There are numerous verses where God speaks of, He speaks of looking into the creation. The ayat is الَّذِي قَلَقَ السَّبْعَ سَمَاوَاتٍ تِبَاقًا مَا تَرَى فِي قَلْقِ الرَّحْمَانِ مِنْ تَفَاوُتٍ. He created seven heavens in layers. You do not see any discordance in the creation of the All Beneficent. He wants us to look at the skies, understand how orderly they are, how the stars move in a particular pattern, how the sun and the moon move. And it should not be surprising, one of the first things we were able to do as human beings in the scientific realm was calculating eclipses before they happened. And it happened more than 5,500 years. 5,500 years ago, human beings were capable of predicting eclipses. For them, it was also important to look at the stars and find their ways. So they looked at the stars for a purpose. The stars would guide them on the path which they wanted to go, whether they wanted to go east or west. They knew how to do it. The stars guided them. So the stars were a guide to them. And they studied it with that intent as well. So never would the stars go wrong. And so you wouldn't go wrong if you're following the right direction shown by the stars. So it all started with this kind of idea. Quran re-emphasizes it. The Quran re-emphasizes it. It is part of the tradition which has come. And as the Prophet says, وَمَا كُنْتُ بِدْعَمْ مِنَ الرُّسُلِ. I am not a novelty among the apostles. I am not somebody who is coming with new things to you. What has already been given to the earlier prophets, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and the other tribes, that's what has been given to me. I'm just giving you what is already there. So this part, which is now reflected, that he's created the heavens, and you will not find any discordance in them, is just one verse where the human mind is made to look at the patterns behind the movement of the stars. And once you start to look at the patterns, you start to do calculations about them, either to find a direction or when the occurrence of an eclipse, lunar or solar, would take place. The ayats move forward. They get more and more intense. It goes in this manner. Allahu allazi rafa'a as-samawati bighayri amadin tarawnaha. It is Allah who raised the heavens without any pillars that you see. It is Allah who raised the heavens without any pillars that you see. He has raised it. There are pillars all right, but they are pillars which we are unable to see. The idea of gravity and gravitation is being put through in very simple terms. It is not just bodies moving around each other. It is pillars which are not visible to us. They are unseen. The world is, but you will not be able to see them with pillars that you cannot see, without any pillars that you see. We move further. The ayat goes like this, وَتَرَى الْجِبَالَ. You see the mountains. تَحْسَبُهَا جَامِدَةً وَهِيَ تَمُرُّ مَرَّ السَّحَابِ. And you see the mountains which you suppose to be stationary, while they drift like passing clouds, the handiwork of Allah who has made everything faultless. He is indeed aware of what you do. Now, if you note this verse, it's very clear and says, and you see the mountains which you suppose to be stationary. The verse is very obvious. You can look at any translations done by the Christians and other non-Muslims about these verses of the Quran. Very simple, very straight. You can talk to any Arabic speaking non-Muslim and he'll give you the same translation. وَتَرَى الْجِبَالَ وَتَرَى الْجِبَالَ تَيْسَبَحَا جَامِدَ وَهِيَا تَمُرُّ مَرَّ السَّحَابِ. And you think that they are stationary while they drift like passing clouds, the handiwork of Allah. Now, the world is rotating around its axis. The mountains are rotating along with it, similar to the clouds, the way they move. But you, he says, look at it as something stationary. But they are moving like clouds. Something again, hidden to us, part of the unseen, but again guiding us towards the complexity of the creation. Again, guiding us to the complexity of the creation. Other verses are there. وَإِنْ مِنْ شَيْءٍ إِلَّا يُصَبِّحُ بِحَمْدِهِ وَلَكِنْ لَا تَفْقَهُونَ تَزْبِيحَهُمْ. There is not a thing but celebrates His praise, but you do not understand their glorification. Indeed, He is all forbearing, all forgiving. When the initial part of these verses are there, He mentions a sign of God and then says He's forbearing, He's all forgiving. In the other verses, He moves on to say He's indeed aware of what you do. So this is the way God, in the same verse, puts forward a sign of God, and by the end of the verse, He mentions that He is aware of what you do. He mentions that He is forbearing, He is forgiving, linking that your understanding of this phenomenon will take time. Till that time, we would be forbearing, we would be forgiving. So as the human civilization moves forward and forward and forward, understanding all these signs now as scientific data, as scientific knowledge, we start feeling that there is something beyond all this which we need to understand. And the verse which says, having faith in the unseen, is basically trying to put all these things in a perspective. Your knowledge is limited. You don't know that everything is glorifying God. We had a very, very stagnant view of matter till we saw how the atoms are, how they work, how the subatomic forces act, how the strong and the weak nuclear force interact, and how the weak nuclear force results in the creation of this world the way it is, by slowly allowing matter to degenerate. Had it not been for the weak nuclear forces, matter would not have been what it is. We would not have the elements which we have today. We wouldn't have the compounds which we have today as a result. And therefore the world of today would not have been possible at all. The materials on which technology is based have all come as a result of the weak nuclear forces pushing matter into decay, and the decayed matter is slowly being used by us today in the form of elements and compounds which harness our material growth. All this is there. As he says, you don't understand their glorification. So the idea was, you understand the world to be stagnant. You understand the mountains to be stationary. Everything you understand, I understand it differently. But I am guiding you towards a higher reality. What happens to those who have faith in the unseen? They had the basic idea of God, right? Hudallil muttaqeen allazina. Guidance to the muttaqeen who develop these kind of features as well. They are muttaqeen who have faith in the unseen. They are muttaqeen who maintain prayer. They are muttaqeen who give of what they have been given. They are muttaqeen who have faith in the book given to the Prophet and the books before him. And then they have faith in the hereafter. There is a whole pattern. I have just translated the initial verses of Surah Baqarah. يؤمنون بالغيب ويقيمون الصلاة ومما رزقناهم ينفقون الذين يؤمنون بما أنزل إليك وما أنزل من قبلك وبالآخرة هم يوقنون. This journey which people take and start looking beyond what is visible, they have faith in that. They know the world is not as it seems to them. It is much, much more complicated than what it looks to be. And in today's time, this has become very, very obvious. Totally obvious. There is no doubt about the fact that we are in this world today with a lot of things known to us which were not known to people even 70-80 years ago. I was speaking in the last lecture about considering the world about 50 years ago to be eternal, the universe, and now we have started saying that it started off with the Big Bang, and this is something around 50 odd years ago when we were able to see the glow of the Big Bang, the microwave cosmic radiation or the cosmic microwave radiation. So as we move along and as we take our new roads towards understanding nature more and more, it goes back to that same verse of the Quran, الَّذِينَ جَاهَدُوا فِينَا لَنَهْدِيَنَّهُمْ سُبُلَنَا, those who strive in us, we surely guide them to our ways. As I told you earlier also, Newton was a theologian. His work on theology is much more than his work on physics and maths. But since he was a Unitarian, his work has not been made popular. The reason being very plain. The church had to hold sway over religion, specifically Christianity, and therefore that effort to keep his science away was not possible, so they kept his religion away. His ideas were born in theology and got interpreted in the form of laws. These were people who were trying day in and day out to understand how the world is functioning, because they knew there was a ghaib in it, in form of the ultimate reality, that is God. And between God and us, there are numerous, maybe infinite steps which have been taken to come to this point in time. And they had reason to pursue this because of that faith. Others who didn't believe in God at all, tell me, what have they been able to create? Which civilization have they been able to give birth to? Which great scientific discoveries came through them? What is the system which they gave to us during our own times, which is not based on the work of the earlier ones who were steeped in religion in one form or the other? Their inquiry was not atheistic, nor was their inquiry into nature agnostic. They believed in perfection of creation and moved forward on that basis. There is another verse here which the Quran very specifically says. Here it is. Yeah. Who perfected everything he created. Allazi ahsana kulla shay'in khalaq. He perfected everything he created. The perfection of God was visible to these people whom the Quran says muttaqeen, and who have faith in the unseen. They saw some kind of perfection and they pursued that perfection. And once they started pursuing that perfection, slowly through that perfection they started understanding beauty. From that beauty they were able to deduce laws, mostly mathematical laws. Mathematics, as you all know, or maybe some of you might have also studied it, is a human created science. We humans have created mathematics. It's a human created science. How did it get created? They saw perfection, and in that perfection they saw beauty, and in that beauty they saw laws of mathematics, and they wrote those laws. There is a lot of discussion on the concept of beauty in mathematics. Anybody who is interested can search the internet. You will find some very good lectures on that, how beauty plays a role in the creation. And as God says here, that we have created, we have created everything with perfection. Allazi ahsana kulla shay'in khalaq. There is another verse which says atqana. He has solidly based everything he has created. That means it has a proper system which doesn't change in time. Laws could be correct before a period of time, then they would change after a period of time, then they would change after a period of time. That would be possible. But God says, no, I don't do that. My laws are strongly rooted, firmly rooted, and on the basis of that firm rooting do I create my creation. La tabdila li khalqillah. That's another word. There is no change in the creation of God. That is, the laws which are working in the universe are working in as a constant, and they don't keep changing for us to feel that today there will be one law, tomorrow there will be another law. It doesn't work that way. The laws of God, the laws of creation are firm, are perfect. Why is Quran drawing our attention towards these things? Because if Quran doesn't draw our attention towards these things, we would be understanding God with some kind of doubt, and with doubt progress stops. Every point where doubt comes, human beings don't move forward on the path which is difficult to traverse. In the state of doubt, human beings prefer to travel the lower path, not the more difficult path. So doubt, I am pointing out to a very, very, very important aspect of human activity. When there is doubt, human beings want to do something which is not very exerting, which is not pushing them to their limits, which is enjoyable. They will only pursue a difficult path when they have real reason for that path to have something good for them, in the form of any result or in the form of some satisfaction of the pursuit itself. Maybe the pursuit might not have a result, but the path itself would satisfy them. A lot of research has happened. With 10 years of effort, the person has concluded that no, this idea of his doesn't have the required proof. He has left it. But the pursuit has taught him a lot of things, which he again applies to some other question which he is going to take after that. Till that point, nobody wants to approach things which have something which is not promising at all to them. And if there is no promise, they go to the easier path, and the easier path is not a path of progress and growth. So civilization developed as a result of people taking the more difficult path, and they took the difficult path basically because they were confident of taking that path and were satisfied that if they took that path, they would get results, if not now, then later, or at least the next generation would come and build on their work, and then they would deliver something more useful and important. That is how religion led civilization. As I quoted, I suppose, Bertrand Russell last time, he said that Islamic civilization led the human civilization for 1000 years. We are a 1400 year old religion. We are a 1400 year old religion. In that 1000 years of leading the human civilization is a big and long period, coming from somebody who says that he is an agnostic. He is accepting the fact that a religion of this kind, coming in a place which had no knowledge of any sort available to the person who gave that religion. The script of that religion had just developed during the lifetime of the Prophet himself. When the Prophet was a child, Arabic got a script. And there were 17 people who were able to read and write, and the Prophet was not one among them. And there was hardly any literature apart from poetry of the worst kind which was available to the Arabs of that time in writing. So somebody comes with this kind of a religion, and that religion, coming not from a civilization which had already been established, but from a civilization which was hardly having a written tradition, no tradition at all, he comes forward and gives the idea of religion that continued to lead mankind for 1000 years. They took from everywhere, developed it. We took the zero from India. But we used that zero everywhere. We got it into algebra. We got it into algorithms. We used the zero other places as well, in physics and optics. We did everything with the zero. We got logic from the Greek, roughly around maybe 30 to 70 concepts, and moved it to 700 concepts plus. More than 10 times of what we took from them. And why and how did it happen? From a people who had no knowledge of, and whose prophet was called Ummi, belonging to the people who did not know how to read and write. Ummi means belonging to the people, not knowing how to read and write. Compared to the Ahle Kitab, the people of the book, who had scriptures for thousands of years. The Jews specifically. You can just imagine how all this moves us towards a higher level of understanding. I will try to expound on why God wants us to go through this process. Why God wants us to go through this process of the unseen, having faith in the unseen. That only leads you to appreciate God in a bigger way, because you don't know that everything glorifies Him. But the word says everything glorifies Him, but you don't know. You can't hear them glorify the God. And this person who has the initial level of taqwa and faith and God consciousness has faith in this word of God. When God speaks of the mountains not being stationary, he starts to study them and goes and finds that there is rotation involved. Similarly, he speaks and sees that the God has spoken about there being no pillars visible to him, but the pillars there are. And then he goes into the idea of getting into understanding gravity. This is how human civilization moves forward. How religion moves the human civilization forward, and how Islam was able to lead the human civilization for 1,000 years out of the 1400 years of its complete period from the time of the prophets Baisat till now, 1440 odd years. If you put it in the solar calendar, it's not even 1400 years, it's 1399. The Iranians follow that calendar. It's 1399. So we are not 1400 years old as yet from the time of the Baisat. Considering this, we need to understand. And from there, how the thing moves. Once you have faith in the unseen, then things are more complex. We are guiding you towards the complexity. Try to understand. Appreciate it. We would like you to appreciate it. Think about it. And when you feel that there is something so powerful in the unseen, you start worshipping the unseen God with greater power. Because He is the source of all that which is unseen. So He becomes the Zahir and the Batin, as the Quran says. He is behind all this unseen laws. But since the unseen laws are controlling things you see, He is the Zahir also. That is, He is seen through His laws in the skies. He is seen through His laws in the material we see, which we thought was stagnant, which is not. We see through the heavens which have been raised without pillars, the mountains which are moving like clouds. We see all this. In that we see God as the Zahir of it and as the Batin of it. And therefore He becomes the Awwal and the Akhir of it. The Quran says, Huwal Awwal Huwal Akhir. He is the first one and He is the last one. And we get sandwiched in between. So there is God in us. There is God around us. And when we are three, He is the fourth. When we are five, He is the sixth. is closer to us than our jugular veins, and he keeps moving us on the path of guidance when we struggle on his paths. Allazina jahadu fina. This is the kind of approach which Quran wants. Now I'll just move forward on the introductory verse of the Surah Baqarah, which says, Allazina yuminuna bil ghaibi wa yuqimuna salat. Once that glory of God is understood by having faith in the unseen, they start maintaining worship, doing salat. Once that salat is done, they start moving towards their responsibility towards other human beings in the way of allazina yunfiquna bima, those who give out of what they have been given. Mimma razaqnahum yunfiqun, that which they have been given, they start giving out to people. So now the faith starts from the unseen to maintaining prayer for the power that has created all this unseen, then moving out with that power acquired through prayer towards society and bestowing on society what has been given to you, both in the material form and in the form of knowledge. Then moving out, extending yourself out into other communities by having faith in the book which is being given through the prophet and the books which are revealed to prophets before the prophet. That means extending your relationship to all the world who have got books, and as the Quran says, we have not left a single community without a prophet. Developing relationship with the whole world. We have created you, there are so many verses, so that you may know each other. Inna akramakum indallahi atqakum. The most noble amongst you is he who has greater taqwa, is more conscious of God and wary of God. You extend that, yuminuna bima unzila ilayka wama unzila min qablik wabil akhirati hum yuqinun. And then you have that all encompassing reality of akhirat, which is the state of the soul when it starts to move away from the physical world on death approaching him or her, and at that X point he has faith in the hereafter. So his complete journey from the unseen to the fact of his having faith in the again unseen part of Qiyamah is all based on a particular logic which works inside him and which works outside of him. And this is the verse of the Quran which very obviously says, سَنُرِهِمْ آيَاتِنَا فِي الْآفَاقِ وَفِي أَنفُسِهِمْ حَتَّى يَتَبَيَّنَ لَهُمْ أَنَّهُ الْحَقُّ. So we shall show them our signs in the horizons and in their own souls until it becomes clear to them that he is the real one. So that it becomes clear to them. Where are the signs? We shall show them our signs in the horizons and in their own souls until it becomes clear to them that he is the real. So this is the process through which religion starts building in the human being a faith in God, a faith in the creation of God, and faith in the word of God, and faith in the worship of God, faith in extending that goodness into the realm of society through giving, and then through interacting with other communities who have their own scriptures and not fighting them but trying to know and understanding them by having faith in those scriptures as well. And what has been put in those scriptures, maybe which is not in consonance with this book, you will reject it not on the basis of having any animosity to them but on the basis of logic. And that simple principle you follow in your own faith as well. Anything ascribed to the prophet which doesn't tally with and is not in concurrence with the Quran, you reject it. The similar principle is used for the books of the earlier nations. So you're not using two principles for two different groups. For your group, you're accepting a different principle, and for the earlier group, you're accepting a different principle. No, you're following the same principle for your religion, you're following the same principle for the words coming to you from the other books, which according to the scholars of those books have been changed. And there is a lot of apocryphal literature which we have, literature which was accepted as the Bible, which has been sidelined as apocryphal, not to be accepted. Though they were part of the gospel itself earlier on. So now, if we come to this conclusion, we are, I think, and I have wanted to speak something more, which I will put to the next lecture, which is of great importance. How does man and the Quran see the destiny of man? This would be for the next lecture. Next lecture, where what is the destiny of man, how man sees it, and how the Quran sees it. And I think the time is over. Wa akhiru da'wana anil hamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
So I think I've got a few questions that have come through on the chat, and I've got a couple of questions of my own. So if we talk about the Quran, Imam Mujahid, as you referred to in your talk about the Quran being a source of guidance for humanity.
Yeah.
I think, and if I remember correctly, Allama Tabatabai describes religion as a path, as a sirat, which I'm sure you have read. So, you know, people talk about the Quran as being a source of all knowledge.
All knowledge?
Well, you know, the people refer to Quran as it has got knowledge of everything in the world. Or some people seem to refer, you know, there's an ayat in the Quran which says that har cheez, wet or solid, is mentioned in the Quran. Maybe paraphrasing slightly. But the point I was trying to make is that the Quran really focuses on the path. So it's got a guidance on the path for humanity to find God and the path to salvation. So if people, for example, who think that it's got a knowledge of everything, they're looking for things to do with chemistry or physics in detail, the Quran will not have it. Am I right?
I think I've just discussed this in this lecture. Since God is considered to be the creator of the whole universe, and he created it as a result of his knowledge and his power, which are both infinite, he is omniscient and omnipotent, and the sciences are for us to inquire through our faculty. God can hint towards them as signs of God, but he is not going to provide you formulae. He is not going to do the job you should be doing as mathematicians, as physicists, as chemists, as geologists. He will not do that. And he will not give things which you can do through your effort. What he will do is, he will ask you to put that effort.
Right.
He will say that these are laws which won't change, and you can pursue them as fixed laws which will deliver when you put your effort. There is a verse in the Quran which says, O jinn and humans, you will not be able to cross the boundaries of the earth except through force and power.
Yeah.
If you can't do it, do it, but you wouldn't be able to do it except with Sultan, with overwhelming power. Sultan is an overwhelming power, like a sovereign.
Right.
So you should be able to have the power which is not an ordinary power. It has to be an overwhelming power. That means it has to cross the gravitational pull, and only then it will be. This could be an indication. As I told you, the other things in the Quran could be an indication. But it is not going to replace human effort of inquiry through the mental faculty and through the sources of knowledge which Quran has provided and has said, we have given you the heart, the eyes and the ears, so that you understand. So the understanding part is there, and the Quran guides you towards it. Quran would like to create a society based on knowledge, not a society based on conjecture. There are so many verses on that. But for that part, it can only guide you towards it. Your human effort is not going to be lessened in any way by the book. But on the other hand, it will act as a catalyst for extra human effort. And I think the reason which the Muslims were able to do that, and nobody else did it, was basically because of this methodology of Quran, of observation and trying to understand things, trying to understand the ghaib and working and making things happen for yourself. And that's what God would really like to see. He doesn't want us to be coached by Him, apart from the fact that He has given us the faculties to be employed. And if those faculties are employed without the burden of sin, these faculties have another power in them, which is visible again in the teachings of Imam Jafar Sadiq alayhi salam to Jabir ibn Hayyan, who is considered the father of modern chemistry. In one of his prayers, I'm quoting from an Algerian Arab author who has written a book on Jabir ibn Hayyan in the 60s or the 70s. And he says the prayer which was taught to Jabir ibn Hayyan by Imam Jafar Sadiq was of a kind which meant basically, O Jabir, if you are capable of not sinning and not reducing your ikhlas, your purity of intent, if you hold on to that purity of intent, you would be like someone for whom there is no shaitan at all, no Saturn at all. Because Saturn can only beguile those who are not mukhlisin. Because the Quran has said, and God quotes even the shaitan, Saturn, by saying, oh God, I am going to mislead all your servants except the mukhlisin. And Allah Ta'ala also says in the Quran, you can mislead everybody except the mukhlisin. So if you have ikhlas, that is purity of intent, the shaitan doesn't exist for you. This is of great importance in the inquiry of material sciences. Very, very important in the inquiry of material sciences, where you are totally detached from your earnings, your cravings, your hormonal pressures, your societal pressures. You are one with the laws of nature. That's what it is.
Thank you very much, Mujahid. Okay, now some questions have come through here, which I'm just going to read out. This is a question about what do Muslims, or what does, in the light of Islam, what do we understand about Darwin's theory of evolution?
Can I go on?
Yes, please. Yeah. I've muted somebody. Yeah.
Go ahead. Had there been Darwin or no Darwin? Had there been Darwin or no Darwin? The idea of speciation, how did species come about in this world, is very obvious. It's very, very obvious. Species started coming one after another, and there is a proper hierarchy of it. And it's now been established beyond science. Putting Darwin into the whole thing and natural selection, which has been discarded long time ago, is something like a cliche. It is nothing more than that. All the species came. We also came as a species down the line. But what differentiated us from all others was the last phase, because the fetus of every animal, we'll take mammals for example, has the same methodology that a human embryo has. Of the chimpanzees, of the other monkeys, of the other animals, the process is the same, till the last end. But we become infinitely superior somehow, and that is what the Quran explains. That infinite superiority cannot be explained by a 2% change in the DNA between us and the chimpanzees. That should have been 200%. 2% could impact for 200%, 2000%, 200,000%. We are infinitely superior to anything which even the chimpanzees have. Infinitely superior. Keeping that in mind, we need to give an interpretation which is metaphysical. And God gives that interpretation in the Quran. And I think all of us now listening and talking and asking would swear on the fact. That the realization of God is a possibility. Whether we have realized God or not is something different. But I think all of us sitting here are very sure that we can realize God at the lesser level, at the medium level, or the higher levels available to other people. Because what has come into this world through people of that intellect and of that purity, take the prophets, the imams, you will find has come nothing from people who have not taken this path at all. And today's world, which is more agnostic than any time before, at least in actions, we find the degeneration of the environment, with the degeneration of this whole world, the uncouthness of the human spirit, calling it competition, but using laws and pressure on nations and smaller nations specifically to get their will done, and multiplying wealth in ways which is not justifiable at all, with 1% owning 99% of the world's wealth and 1% contributing to 50% of the carbon footprint of the world. So we understand that those who are not willing to go through the process of the metaphysical, that is the process of the roof, the spirit, the soul, are people who are destroying the world, because for them, they are physical, the world is physical, the higher gets the lower, and the world is there to be devoured. Next session, I'll be speaking on the Quranic and Islamic way of looking at the universe and the human life. And then we come back to that. But this question would be a leading question towards that. But I can tell you, Darwin or no Darwin, we are a result of a process of speciation. Species have been formed from the first microbes to us. The process is the same. There is nothing to doubt about it. If we think that God has put clumps of clay and made us, I mean, that is something stupid. And if people think that's the way things have happened, they are stupid. Religion is not. If you consider God to make things like we make statues, this doesn't happen that way. God creates in his own way, and his creation is of a different order altogether. And what we see is his creation. I'll highlight this in the next session, next lecture, inshallah.
Inshallah. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Another question here is about the ruh, the spirit.
Yeah.
The question is it a perfect creation which has ability to transform from different states before conception, in the mother's womb, in this life, after death, and on the day of judgment?
Yeah. There are things regarding the ruh, which the Quran also says. They ask you, O Prophet, about the ruh, say that you have not been given knowledge of it except a little. The soul part is specifically something which you can understand by your own self. It is akin, I'm just giving an example. It is akin to something like what we would call your physical power. What your physical power is, you realize it, how quickly you can walk, how quickly you can stand up while sitting on the ground, how quickly you can turn, how long you can stand on one foot. All this is something you realize and you understand. This is a physical part of you. How many sit-ups you can do, how many push-ups you can do, all this. And you understand you can do this much and you can't do more than that. This is the physical reality of the human being. We'll come to the soul now. As you feel your strength as a human being at different times in your age, as a young boy or a girl to that age of ours which we are now in, plus or minus 60. We know that from weakness to strength, and from strength to weakness, as the Quran says, we created you in a weak state, from weakness, then strength, and then strength to again weakness. Soul also is like that. Maybe it won't start at the 14th or 15th year. But as you progress in your life, and as you start thinking about religion and God, and if you start progressing on that path, the way you realize your body, you realize your soul. Your soul will become as much a reality to you as your body. All of us actually have it. We talk about it. We see it. We are in a proper state when it comes to the body, but we are sad or depressed mentally and at times even spiritually. And there are times when you are physically not at your peak, but still you are happy mentally and maybe spiritually. These different states have come to all of us. one time or the other. We were not very well, we were sick, and some good news came to us. And we became totally forgetful of the fever which we were having and the backache which we were having. The opposite is also true. Try to understand the rule is an effort of us all. To the point that with the whole physical body in place, you can be very, very convenient and comfortable with your Ruh, and your Ruh would be your real self. That is the easiest part of understanding the soul. I'm not going to the higher parts at all. Where you feel your body is like an appendage to the soul. But you will have to feel it. I will have to feel it. Prayer leads to that point very easily, where you start feeling your soul independent of your body. The whole idea of regular worship is that. And if you can come to that state where you feel the soul independent of your body, you start using your body and mind as a slave of the soul. Because now you have got an identity to hold on to. If you don't develop that identity, your mind and your body will slave the soul because you hardly recognize it. So this domain is totally a domain of self-knowledge. God can only guide. Yeah, God can only guide. You have to develop it through your own prayers and worship and through your own effort towards understanding God by moving one step at a time, taking the guidance from the Quran, the prophets and the imams. The soul is easily capable of being understood at the individual level. Explaining is like telling something which cannot be explained. It can be realized. It is like the taste. If you are feeling the taste of a sweet, you are feeling the taste of the sweet. If you are feeling your soul, you are feeling your soul. I can only tell you that it is as sweet as the sweet you taste. It could get sweeter as you work on it. And if you don't, it will become a burden for you. And your physical life, as it slowly seeps away from you, takes your body on the journey towards the grave, the feeling of living an empty life, a life which is soulless, which can become more and more visible as we come closer to our death. So it's better for all of us, I'm speaking about myself in this regard, to become more serious of identifying our soul as an independent existence, because after death, it is going to become independent of this body. It is going to become independent of this body. We have a lot of near-death experiences which have been recorded in all religions. And people who didn't even have faith have recorded this kind of thing, that when we were dying, we were being separated from the body we had. And we were looking at the body and we were not part of that body. Then suddenly things happened that body got restored. So the part of the soul is, as long as the body is capable of holding the soul is attached to the body. And once the body becomes incapable of holding the soul leaves. That's the way the soul works. But when it is with us in the body, it is the soul which needs to be realized. Body can be realized by even animals. This I'll again explain more in detail in the next lecture, I suppose. And soul, I'm again telling you, is the only thing we are in search of. Because it's the soul which searches God. If we have a weak soul, our search of God becomes weak. If we have a strong soul, we will search God day in and day out. And we will search in God, as the Quran says, Allazina jahadu fina. Those who search in us, those who strive in us, that is God. He uses a plural for himself. Us means God and his creation. So that is the real part of the Ruh. And once it does that act, it feels satisfied because it's in its natural domain, not the domain of the material pleasures. The material pleasures are for the mind and the body, and the spiritual pleasures are for the soul. Small dosages of spiritual pleasure will make you addicted to them. And the more you get addicted, the more greater benefit you would be doing to your body and mind, and through it, through the whole world, including your family, friends, relatives, and even enemies. You will not hate them the way you and I generally do. I'm speaking about myself, not about you.
thank you, Mujahid. Thank you very much. I've had a request from one of the participants. Mehdi Ashraf would like to ask you a question. Mehdi, if you are you can unmute yourself and ask the question.
Assalamu alaikum, Mujahid sahab.
Assalamu alaikum.
Yeah, I'm Azerbaijan's friend. I have been following your lectures, and like today's lecture, you went into the details of how the Islamic civilization led the human behavior for 1,000 years, and how our religious scholars led to scientific inventions and discoveries, which later benefited the world, and especially the modern world. It has been benefiting the modern world, the discoveries and inventions of the Muslim philosophers or Muslim theologists. Now, and as you said, past 400 years or 500 years, there is a complete decline. And with my experience of having lived in Hyderabad, going to the regular majalis, and then having lived in Miami, Florida, very rarely I have come across religious scholars who there's so much of reverence to the scholars. I've hardly come across religious scholars who have talked about unity among the Ummah of the Prophet or progress among the Muslims. Zero, sir. No exceptions. And that is why universally, with 1.8 billion Muslims, please look at our status. Whether you are in the United States or whether you are in Europe or whether you are in countries like India and Pakistan. Now, I personally, I hold. I'm sorry, I'm not talking about you.
You can speak about me or everybody. You are free. Please go ahead. Please go ahead.
No, I'm so impressed. I personally hold the religious scholars responsible. From my young age, when I was a very small, whether you say Akhtar Zaidi or whether you say, any Maulana, it has become now when I look back, and if I go to a lecture, a sermon, and it just strikes me, what is this guy talking? I mean, the level of intellect is so low. And unfortunately, there are very few Mujahid Sahab, but there are 99.9% of those. Can you please comment on that?
See, the reason for the decline of the Muslim Ummah has basically been what God would say. God gave us a chance and we performed. And then we renegated on those principles which brought us to that point. What brought us to the point of success was a particular way of thinking and doing things. Our commitment to truth and justice, because you cannot have it one way. Your commitment to truth would be automatically your commitment to justice. It cannot be otherwise. These two concepts are totally interwoven, two sides of the same coin. What happened is, with wealth coming to us and we started partaking of it independently of our duty towards others. So we became a small elite who got slowly used to the Epicurean delights of his well-being and degenerated. And with their degeneration, and since they were the people having the knowledge of sciences and arts, the whole civilization imploded. And as you said, it should be including the ulama as well as the people who were ruling at that time and the bureaucracy of the Muslims. It is just not the ulama per se. It is all three of them. The umara, the rulers, the noblemen, the kings, and the clergy, all put together, the top echelons of our society were basically living a life of debauchery. And this is very clearly mentioned in the works of certain philosophers such as Averroes, Ibn Rushd. He said, we are fighting our enemy with one hand. That he meant we are only the men who are fighting. Our women have been converted into plaything for men. They don't have a role in society any longer. When the role of the mother as a point of instruction is taken away from the mother and her physical form is given more importance, you can just imagine the society what it will be. And I think slowly it's coming to that in the Western society as well, where women are being treated more as physical than as those having that, what we call in our language as mamta, and the ability to be the first teachers of their children. So let us first honor our women. Let us first honor the principles of truth and justice. And then let us move on the path of religion and see then what happens. You cannot choose your own rules to play God's game. You cannot choose your own rules to play God's game. He will set the rules. He will put the things in place. And if you don't, in Uttum Udna says the Quran, if you turn back, we turn back. Very, very simple words. In Uttum, if you turn, Udna, we turn. And that's what has happened to us. We turned our back on God and then God turned his back on us. And today we are in the state that we have bought ourselves into and everybody is supposed to be blamed. And as the Quran says, anybody who has the khashya, the awe of God, is an alim. Because the Quran says, innama yakhsha allaha min ibadihi al-ulama, none except the ulama are in awe of God. So any one of us who is in awe of God is an alim, according to the Quran. We have put dress above everything. We have put the unnatural ways of behavior above everything. So people started to act as ulama. You don't need to be an alim to be acting like an alim. Simple. So we got people who started acting like ulama. They were not in awe of anybody, leave alone God. And if they were in awe of anybody, it was the wrong people. So they were in awe of the majority, what the majority wanted. And they acted and spoke the way the majority wanted them to act and speak, not the way God wanted them to act and speak. And this we can see in even the khutbah of Imam Hussein, which he delivered in 58 Hijri during the reign of Muawiyah in the in Mecca. I think it was Arafah, and there he pointed out to the ulama that you are not fulfilling your duty of supporting the cause of truth because you fear death. And you love this world's life. These two reasons are the cause for you getting away from the path of God. And as a result, you have handed over the weak to the tyrants. You have handed over the weak, the oppressed to the tyrants. And as a result of that, what is happening is happening. This was continued even later on. And by the time the European civilization started to take wings, we slowly regressed into worse and worse kind of what we call political power, and the political power led to the social upheavals, and the social upheavals led to our leaving the path of science and math and progress, and today we stand, as Iqbal would say, naked in front of the world. Naked in front of the world. Our intellectual garments have all been discarded by us and partly taken away by others. Thank you.
Thank you, Mujahid. One more question has come through to me on WhatsApp. Is in the West, we have, as we know, we have separation of church and state. You know, in the post-enlightenment world in the West. But in Islam, the view is that we have no such separation. But in practice, is it fair to say that our imams were not involved in state because, you know, politics is dirty and there is corruption and so on, with the exception of this wilayat-e-faqih, which is being practiced in Iran. So what should be a Muslim's attitude? Should he, as you mentioned in your talk, view God as a personal God and somebody that you have a personal connection with, and you try to improve yourself, you do your tazkiyah nafs, you do all of those things, or should he be involved in politics and try to change things in society?
The idea about religion from the very beginning had been linked to the idea of justice. The verse in the Quran, verse number 25 of chapter Al-Hadith, Iron, says, لَقَدْ أَرْسَلْنَا رُسُلُنَا بِالْبَيِّنَاتِ. Surely we have sent all our Rusul, our apostles, with clear proofs. وَأَنْزَلْنَا مَعْهُمُ الْكِتَابِ. When we have sent along with them the book, والميزان, the balance, لَيَقُومَ النَّاسُ بِالْقِسْطِ, so that people may uphold justice. Mankind may uphold justice. The whole idea of ruling over somebody is basically to rule with justice. And nobody rules in his name, but in the name of God. Because no human being in any way has power over another human being. Unless he has a principle which is accepted as a just principle. And on the same principle of justice, he will be tried as he tries others. The same principle, he will be tried on which he tries others. And he, if he is wrong, is expected to be a witness against himself, as the Quran says, against your parents, against your brothers. This is how justice has to be maintained, upheld in society. If this idea of justice doesn't percolate down till the last person, the chance of a society acting on the principles of justice is not there, irrespective whether the society is a secular society or a religious society. In the modern world, the idea of what is just with limited resources and unlimited wants is impossible. If somebody goes hungry and you are and I am enjoying millions and having a millions more in the bank, you will say, he has not done his job, what can I do? His parents have not given him education, what can I do? If he is born blind, what can I do? If he had polio at the age of 3 and 4 and 5, what can I do? If he was born to lepers, what can I do? And all of us will say, what can I do? Because there is nobody responsible and you don't feel your responsibility, I don't feel mine. So the secular world can very conveniently, on a philosophical basis of materialistic philosophy, can put thousands and millions to death through malnutrition and hunger, as it is happening in a lot of places in the world today, through wars which have been started with a political intention and led to the starvation of millions of people all around Africa, Asia, Middle East, and even worse, if the time, if it is that the idea of karma, that a person who is born poor or blind or has been afflicted with polio or leprosy, all this is the result of his karma of the past. He did something wrong and that has led to him being born in this state. You not only give anything to him, you sneer at him. You sneer at him.
I can learn to understand you much better if I can get familiar with the way.
So, we need to understand very clearly that there is no philosophical underpinning of the present political system which is based on material understanding of the world. So you come back to only one thing. If you want to have a philosophical basis of the creation of mankind and the responsibility of man, then we come on to the principle of a philosophical, spiritual principle in which I and he stand on the same ground. If I am getting more and he is getting less, we have to devise ways at least not to be inhuman in this world. And I think we have enough resources for that. Today's modern political thought is not offering answers for the degenerating amongst humans, for the degenerating of places, of farmlands, of glaciers, everything which is being wasted as a result of our understanding of an exclusive kind which is not having any philosophical underpinning, and as a result, it is basically carpe diem. Enjoy the day and everything is fine with the world. As it is said, God is in heaven and everything is well with the world. This doesn't work on a philosophical basis, and it is proven to not work in the realm of the today's world relation between the haves and the have-nots. The communist interpretation has failed because the greed which was there in the capitalist became 10 times more in the communist official. The capitalist struggled to get his capital. They robbed the capitalist of his capital and took the same benefits. Therefore, they collapsed. So the only possible thing is man should outgrow his physical, and then in that state of the spirit, he would be able to produce more and want less. And in this process of producing more and wanting less, he would be able to transfer a bit of what he earns extra instead of his own aggrandizement towards those hungry children, widows, orphans and others, and then move things in that direction. It looks to be utopian. It looks to be idealistic because the paradigm we have chosen for ourselves is one based on hedonism. Remove that and it becomes practical. And now, I think I don't need to answer the question whether we require to have a vilayate fakhi or not.
I think, yeah, I mean, clearly in a society like Iran, I think it probably makes sense where the vast majority are followers of Marjaiyat and the role of the ulama. Maybe elsewhere it won't make sense.
But it will make sense to us at least if we understand ourselves. We are not slaves of anybody except God.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And our duty to Him is there and we are answerable to Him. We can be good citizens of every society, but our consumption habits, our consumerism, our hedonism are all personal choice. Are all personal choice. Either the time where we have been born and the place where we are living is going to dictate what we are going to do. That means we are living in time and space and we will not be able to access God unless we start to come out of that prison of our own creation. That's what I'm saying.
Understand. I think we've got literally 3 minutes or 4 minutes left. If anybody has got a question, either quickly raise your hand and come on the camera. You might have one last question that Aga can possibly answer. Anyone got any question? No, nope. Doesn't look like it.
Assalamualaikum.
Can I just... Yes, please.
Well, Aga Sahib, Assalamualaikum. I'm Dr. Sajjan Akhi from Pakistan.
As
Mr. Abdi, he put up a question that... our IMA, they really didn't participate in political system in the government issues. And that somehow or the other gives us a lead that the church and the government or mosque and the government, they are something two different things. Religion, the following of religion is something else, and the government is something else. And some or the other, in Islamic philosophy, although the guidelines are there, but unfortunately, we could not develop any political system which is to be followed. Only two countries in the world, they claim, although Pakistan says this Islamic Jamhuriya Pakistan, Islamic Republic of Pakistan, But still two countries, they claim that we are absolutely Islamic countries and our government is absolutely Islamic. One is Iran and one is Saudi Arabia. And many objections are there because they have formulated their governmental system according to their requirements as this issue of Vilayat-e-Faqih. So I think that part of Azarbhai's question is still to be discussed, that the concept of the concept of government according to the Islam and or the religious people or the pious people, they participating in the government, that still remains there. And if you have a short of time,
I'll go into that very simply. You'd be surprised that the followers of Hazrat Ali were governors during the period of the second Khalifa, Salman-e-Farsi, Ammar-e-Yasir. They were governors. In the time of the seventh Imam, we have Ali ibn Yaqtin as ministers with Harun al-Rashid. Others also had asked permission from our Imams, can we become governors? The Imams have said yes. There is a whole discussion on the principle of accepting the governorships of those in power after accepting the fact they are not the right people to govern. And the permission has been granted by the Imams. Provided you work for the cause of Islam and the people, not for what they are. So if you are serving the people through that post, if you are serving Islam through that post, you are acceptable. And this is the permission given by the Imams. The one reason that the Imams were always being controlled by the Khulafa of their times, and it's so very obvious that the 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th and 11th Imams have died where the Khulafa were there. 7th Imam Harun Rashid in Baghdad, 8th Imam in Mashhad, where he was coming along with Mamun al-Rashid towards Baghdad and he didn't want him to be in Baghdad with him. Therefore, he tried to kill him at Taraq, northern Iran, north of Mashhad. And there he was not successful. He poisoned him in Mashhad, in Khurasan. 9th Imam, the Khilafat had gone back to Baghdad. The 9th Imam died there. 10th and 11th Imams, both lived in Samarra. The Khilafa at that time had moved from Baghdad to Samarra. So when you see that the Khilafat is not allowing the Imams any kind of space, had they just been spiritual people, they would have been left to themselves. Because they were spiritual people and were guiding people in the sphere of politics, either by becoming governors or ministers and at times asking people to not support the Khilafa, where the Imams told Safwan and Jamal that the kind of things which you are doing by hiring the camels for Hajj is not proper because you expect the Khalifa to live till you get back your caravan from Hajj and he pays you. So they were that political. When it came to the coining of the Islamic coin, you have the role of the fifth Imam. The earlier coins being used in the Islamic world were Roman coins. And the Roman emperor once gave a warning that if you don't accept some of the conditions we are putting, we will write curse on our coins and circulate it, curse on the Prophet on our coins and circulate it in your domain. At that point, it was the Imam who guided the Khalifa of that time to mint coins in the Islamic world. So we have this kind of thing where the support, Hazrat Ali's support to the three Khulafa, obvious, he's taking the Khilafat on insistence of the people, obvious. Had this not been the rule, they wouldn't have done it. And if they don't do it, they can't expect other people to do justice when they themselves are unwilling to come forward and do justice. So they never went for the government. They never wanted power for power's sake, but they were guiding people towards a purer form of government. Therefore, the Khulafa, who had now developed love for the world, and wine and women had come in the darbar, they were totally opposed. There was a famous poet, Debal. One of his poems was, he said, what can I say now when the Khulafa are enjoying their drinks like the emperors of Rome? One of the reasons the Imams liked him was this. He would openly criticize the Khulafa and their behavior in the darbar. So we have to understand that. Talking power to the powerful is the highest jihad. We have a riwayat. Talking truth to the powerful is the highest jihad. So we have to do that. And whatever is being done today by somebody or not, I won't take example of any country. I will not take the example of Iran. I will not take the example of Saudi Arabia. Everybody has their own issues to deal with. But I can tell you, we are speaking purely from the point of view of religion of God. And God doesn't segregate between the church and the state. The church... If the church segregated from the state will destroy itself, and the state segregated from the church will destroy itself.
Then this point becomes, you know, evident that being a religious person and believing in the religious philosophy, you should keep supporting the government, whatever is there, as far as they are doing the right thing. You just keep on supporting the government. You can always oppose the government if you feel that they are against the Islamic philosophy. But as long as in the normal functioning of the state, you need not to really interfere or participate. And as far as you mentioned that so many Sahaba of the Ayyam alayhi wasalam, they became governors, I think they just reciprocated to their political interests or political offers of the Abbasides. Because they just know, it's just like making Imam Ali alayhi salam as crown prince. That was just a political move. And some or the other, they, you know, reciprocated to that their political moves.
I think we've run out of time now. Thank you very much, right. Sajjad Bhai. Sorry to cut you off there. Right. Awa Mujahid, again, bahut bahut shukriya. Thank you very much indeed. As you said in your talk, either people contribute materially, but by contributing your knowledge, I think you've really helped the audience in understanding some of these concepts of the unseen, and we look forward to your next week, in a couple of weeks' time, inshallah. Jazakallah, and...